History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that really should not go untold. And by now we should know they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then invest enough time to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new relevance in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we do find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It is Father's Day weekend, and we get to meet a father today who recently got to enjoy quite an experience with his son, an honor flight to Washington, D.C. We'll hear about that before we're done with Navy veteran Bob McAvoy of Clovis, California, originally from the Keystone State of Pennsylvania. So first of all, tell me about your childhood. You grew up in Pittsburgh. What do you remember about those early years?
Living with my grandparents, because it was the Great Depression, and the jobs were hard to get, and I recall being in my grandparents' home, except for one item about the big fire across the street in southern Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Seeing the rabbits that my dad and his brother brought home in the Depression years, when he tried to put meat on the table. It's one of the things of my earliest in that fire. But in my grandparents' home, my dad and his brother had by then hopped on a train and went to California seeking jobs. My sister and I, I recall, at my grandparents' home, they had, my grandparents were members of a card club of neighbors, and my sister and I had to dust. They came down for card parties. Well, this was a dining room thing, a table, and it was pretty large. It was old-fashioned and big, heavy legs on it, and Grandma always had a big cover over the top of it. It was beautiful furniture, but when my sister had to do the dusting, we had to get under the thing, under the table, and get it, and we used to sit under there and giggle. And I still remember, we were so close. It was just a year and a half between us in age. We'd get under there and start giggling and laugh our heads off. But not with anybody here, of course. We weren't even be allowed to see what they were doing. We had to get out of there.
Your mother left the family when you were very young, and then your father comes out to California for work. So in many ways, you were raised by your grandparents, right?
Exactly, yes, indeed. That was most of my bringing up.
Your grandfather, who raised you, he was a veteran of a war that most of us don't hear too much about. When did your grandfather serve?
He was in that Spanish-American War. That's all I know.
And I'm always interested because the war interrupted so many lives and it changed everybody's lives. Do you remember before the war having some thoughts in your head of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do, this is who I'm going to try to become, or any of those dreams or ambitions you remember?
No. Honestly, the biggest thing that happened to me was in my very early, maybe 10 or 11 years old, I got a balloon-tired bicycle for Christmas. Wow! I was eye out of sight, man. From then on, they never saw me. Honest to Pete, I'd get on that thing after breakfast in the morning, and if it wasn't at school time, what I'm trying to say is, when I got free time to get out of the house and on a bicycle, wow, I went. I mean, it didn't matter how many miles I was going. I was just going just to be doing it, and I grew up on that darn thing. I mean, my legs are so, these things have a lot of muscle in them, but they're kind of leaving away from me because I don't use them enough anymore, but they're strong enough to hold me up. The only thing is my equilibrium is not too good, so I have to be careful when I'm walking.
So you mentioned December 7th, 1941, and it seems like everybody has some kind of memory. What's your memory of that day?
It was a Sunday morning. And I think I mentioned previously about being a Catholic family, so they were practicing Catholic family too, but my grandparents are kind of strict, but I just take this all in because I'm just a youngster. And on that day, we were sitting in the living room, and we had this big round radio that everybody had at that time. And we were listening to the news, and when all just came on, bam, everybody looked at each other, and the whole family, just my grandmother and grandfather were there, and my sister and I. Uncle Ray must have been there because he was still living at home at that time. The news to me was, I don't think all that came to me at once, but maybe a day or two later, honestly, it sank in then. And like I told you, I wasn't too good to my grandparents in raising us because, like I told you, after I got that bicycle, I was gone. I was hardly ever at home anymore. So I had that kind of atmosphere that I just wanted to do what I wanted to do. I'd go by an orchard, and I'd go over, and I'd pull an apple down off the tree and keep on going. Something like that, you know. Anyway, after the December 7th thing, and the next day, I guess I started thinking about it, and also them said, go in the Navy. I wanted to join the Navy and let it ride around on the ships.
Well, let's talk about that. Why not the Army or the Marines or anything else? Why the Navy?
Because I was so skinny and slow and small in stature. I didn't develop muscles or anything like that. And I thought to myself, going in the Army, they got a lot of gear they got to carry around. In fact, that was a mistake on my part because, like, getting off to the side at the training camp when I went in the Navy, was up in Newport, Rhode Island in December, and cold. Rhode Island's out of on the East Ocean, Atlantic Ocean. December, colder than H-E-double-L. And it was a riot. There were, I don't know how many, but we were only there 2 weeks. That's the emergency, going through it to get you in there and tell you what to do and get the heck out and get in action. So it was only 2 weeks spent at it, but the only thing we did was march. We learned how to march together, and we had wooden rifles that we carried around with us, and we'd do all that things, you know, that the Marines do, like a bam. Those guys are something else. That's when we came down to South Boston. After 2 weeks, took us down there, put us aboard the USS San Diego, which was commissioned in January the 10th, 1942. We got stored up and everything, and I don't know what the date was when we left there, but when we left, our first cruise was up to East Coast, and we went north up to Maine. We went into Portland, Maine. We anchored out there for a night or so, but it was so beautiful up there. There are small islands all around Portland, and it's just fantastic views. And my head was going right there. I really enjoyed it, you know. And I'll never forget my first step when you get out onto the ocean. We turned out of the harbor and start going north. The sea was pretty calm, except it was wavy, huge waves, but they were soft. But the ship was going up and down like this. And I'm out there on the deck, and the first step I take, the ship goes out from under me, and I go, woo! Holy macaroni, did I get my sea legs in a hurry. And I just kind of concentrated on that. Pretty soon it just grew on me. It didn't cause me anything ever since then. I could just take a bit. It was an instant. I mean, that's something you learn, otherwise you're going to be all over the place. But that first step... It would always come up to my chin. So anyway, we go up there and go through them. Then we turn around and start south. And from there down to Virginia, we did 40 knots in a ship on the ocean. And man, that thing just shaked like you were in a, I don't know what the thing was, that some of the huge air vents you see on the ships catch the air to go down below deck. Those things shivered and shaked, and some of them fell down. We were really bucking that ship up. 40 knots is unheard of. Anyway, we got all the stuff fixed up, and then down there, go down to the Panama Canal, shoot through there, come up to San Diego. The first thing I know, we're out to sea. We stopped in Pearl Harbor. Oil all over the harbor from the all the ships in the December 7th attack. Oh, it was terrible looking stuff and smelled. But we got everything fixed up there, and then the next thing I know, we're going out with the Hornet. And what I failed to tell you about was that the San Diego was one of four anti-aircraft cruisers that were built the same time, I guess. The San Diego, the San Juan, the Atlanta, and the Juno. The Juno was the poorest one, because when she engaged around Guadalcanal, she got sunk in I don't know how many minutes, but almost the whole crew got lost on the darn thing. And right away, all those four ships were changed. No surface engagements. All were anti-aircraft and mostly assigned to carriers, because they're the ones that needed our protection to get some stuff in the air so that the Japs can't get at the carriers. So I get back to where we get into the South Pacific. The Hornet was our first ship that we protected. We were assigned to them for protection. I'm sitting in the seventh turret on the second from the last on the back of the ship. And I was going for gunner's mate because I had been assigned to that turret. I was called the trainer, which I moved the turret in a horizontal position. And the guy on the other side, it was called the pointer, and he controlled the turrets in the up and down side. And then we had, of course, the captain of the turret, first class gunner's mate. He was in charge. I don't know about the advertising. McAvoy, you're going the wrong way. I said, holy mackerel. I'd have to turn back. I didn't do any of them. When he tests that, you go, whoa, it scared the hell out of me. So I was, man, I just wore my arms up. I was turning out like a steam engine, you know, because I realized what it was meant to be. We got to do this fast. There's an alert on. That means there may probably be planes in the air, Japanese planes. So you got to be online. And he was just doing his duty. he's hollered like it in. My hair went up in the air like that. Because I thought, oh, well, I'm going the wrong way. But that didn't happen very often after that, boy. I had to make sure I was going the right way. Port of starboard. You get out there and then just turn the switch. Now that's all I had to do, which was very hard. But what I was leading up to, the first thing of the war meant to me, we were out with the Hornet. We were cruising along in a group around the Guadalcanal area at the start of the war. I'm sitting on the outside my turret. It's just a sunny day, beautiful weather. We're cruising along at 30 knots. Because this, the guy in charge of the Admiral or something, he was known for his speed of staying at 30 knots, because that's hard for a submarine to get at you. But anyway, that's what happened. I'm sitting there, and it's just the steering room, so I'm looking at where we've been, where we're cruising along. The second in command on the ship, it was your lieutenant commander, and I forget what his name was, he was out walking, and he was on here on the starboard side aft of the ship, just out walking. We weren't in any emergency situation. I'm looking at him, and I see him, and I see nothing's going on. But all of a sudden, I looked past him, where my eyes went by him, and I looked out, and there's bubbles coming towards me. I looked, oh, my God, it's a torpedo. And damn it. he looked, I guess he was watching, he saw it too. He turned around and went, zoom, going up the side of the ship. And I looked at that and I watched that thing. And it was no more than 100 yards out and went right past our stern. My God, I said, that was it. Suddenly it woke in my head, man, we were at war. You were almost gone at war. Because that thing hit us, we were gone. But it went right by. And fortunately, it didn't hit any of the ship in the convoy. But for me, that said, this is serious, man. You better get on it and be more alert. And I grew up. I'm telling you, it scared the hell out of me. That's the only thing, as far as my personal being, that happened to me that I was aware of. Of course, scared, too. It was just something to remember. At another time, several months later, we got one of those new battleships in the convoy beside us. I was doing again outside the turret because there wasn't any alert on. It's going along, and we were all doing 30 knots, and that was a beautiful ship, a battleship, with a new battleship. And all at once, I'm looking at it, and man, a huge wave of water goes splatting up in the air, and she takes a torpedo on the port bow, and that water went zoom up. I was like, holy Toledo. Then I heard this thing, and didn't throw it them any good. They just kept on sailing. I mean, it didn't get out of the convoy, didn't do anything. It just, okay, you got your shot. But I couldn't blow. I was glad it wasn't the Ark ship, or we'd have been gone.
Am I remembering correctly that you were there in October of 42 when the Hornet was sunk in the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands? Yes. You witnessed that?
Yeah. Oh, what I remember is those guys jumping off it. That was terrible. We had slowed down because when they were jumping off, and I think there was a destroyer close by that we were picking up some of them, but our captain of the ship probably was ordered to stand by off a little off from it in case the destroyer couldn't get in and need some more, we had to get in, or try to protect it from torpedoes if there was a Jap sub in the area, which of course there was. And so it was a kind of a tedious way for us. We'd slow them down because we're action-wise, you know, we're always going at 25, 30 knots most of the time, and this is all in the Guadalcanal area. That was the scene of activity for the war at the beginning. That was the tough part of the war, that the carriers, which were so needed for shooting down the Japs, and we had to protect them in whatever way we could.
I'm just interested in what you actually saw, because that had to be pretty surreal or jarring for you to see what was happening there.
Yeah, I can't gauge distances, but it was close up enough for us, and I was a little nervous because we were just sitting there waiting. But anyway, that was what was happening in my eyesight, and that seeing those guys jumping over was really tough.
And there would be more challenging days ahead for Bob McAvoy. It's time for our first break. But when we come back, the moment he was jarred awake by something colliding with his ship and penetrating its hull not too far from where Bob was sleeping. And before we're done, his honor flight experience too. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 98-year-old Bob McAvoy of Clovis, California, originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He just turned 98 this week, but according to the Navy, he's been that age for a while. We'll get to that. Bob served aboard three different ships during World War II, but his story might have been quite a bit different if he had offered a different answer to a question he was posed on his first ship, the cruiser USS San Diego.
They asked me, do you want to go back to San Diego to gunnery school? And I said, do I want to go back? I was out in the war zone. Hell yes, I just wanted to go back to San Diego and go to school. And so I did. My father had a place out in the valley, North Hollywood. They dropped me off there to visit my dad, who lived next door to neighborhood family who had a daughter, and that's how I happened to meet her. She was my first wife. She was a tall girl, and we hit it off, and we got married. Graduated from school, and am sent to Tacoma, Washington, I think it was, to be assigned to a troop transport. It's called USS Napa, N-A-P-A. And it's a brand new ship, and I'm another, what do I call them?
Plankoder?
You're a mind reader. A plankoder, right. It's a brand new ship. And so, but I was a gunner's mate. And so they had a 40 millimeter mount on the stern of the ship. I was in charge of that. And so it's a new ship, so we get off, outfitted off. All once we're in the hot harbor and we're going south, and we come down to Pendleton. And we get down in that area and take some Marines on, a section of the 4th Marines. So we load up with them. We go out and join some other ships and go down to Hawaii. New ship, new crew, new Marines. And it's a troop transport, but they have those boats aboard that you have to launch off and they can load Marines on or put it on a small tank or something in them. So everybody's new at it. Load, unload, load, and unload, load, and unload, till we get the darn thing right. Then we head to the South Pacific, where else? That's where the battles are. These Marines are being trained for Iwo Jima. That's where the next stop was. Holy macaroni. That was something else. I mean, talking about being scared. How I admire those Marines. We go in there, let them land, and I'm watching all of this because those are the ones who are being active, and I'm standing by. I'm 40 millimeter mount on the stern of the ship. So I'm just mesmerized is what it is. I am taking all this in. The battle is going on the shore. We're spitting a hauler now from the shore of the small harbor. I don't remember how many ships there were with it, but they're all troop transports. So I go in and I'm sitting there and watching the bag, the battle. And the thing that sticks in my mind is they had these things that flare up all of a sudden. They're thrown in and it, pew, and these Marines all over the place. And these things are strong. And I said, oh, Lord, those poor guys, they've got to take that. I'm just mesmerized. I talk about war. I'm just sitting there, you know, and these guys are, oh, I don't know where they get the, you know what, to go in there like that. I'm just so afraid for the guys. But anyway, when the end of the day comes, the ships up anchor and go out of the harbor because we're that close to Japan and the Japanese bombers. We don't want to be in there anchored when they come in. So we get up and they and go out and circle around the island there until the next morning. So on the fourth day, we're out and we're coming back in. I had the midnight watches, 12 to 4, when we were cruising. And it was a little bit after 4 that I jumped on off the gun turret and get in my bunk. The next thing I know, bam! Holy macaroni! I'm in the second bunk up. There are three bunks, and I'm in the middle. And I wake up, and I'm standing next to on the deck next to my bunk. That thing, it jarred the ship. I said, holy mackerel, we're torpedoed. I turned around, and I look up to the port side, and there's a hunk of iron sticking through the night. I thought, man, it's a torpedo that didn't go off. I can't swim. And my life jacket is up on my gun turret where I left at 4 o'clock. And I first thing I think about, where's my life jacket? So I'm on the port side of the below decks. And when that thing happens and I'm standing there and I says, I got to get to my life jacket right now. So I got bizzling across to the starboard side of the ship to go up. There's a tubby guy right in front of me. And I just rather than say, I'm up there pushing this butt up. I said, get going, man. I got to get up to my life jacket. And I get up there and turn around. There's this other ship, but it wasn't a ship. It was a ship's bow that was stuck through there. I thought it was a torpedo. But then I found out when I get up there, this other ship. And he had backed off and then come alongside again to keep us in balance so we don't take a lot of crap. till we get everything closed down to below deck and get watertight, and we could float by ourselves. So they stand by us that long. But I'll never forget how I had to get that life jacket, because I thought we were going to sink. And then we get up, and that guy on the ship, on the other ship, even though they were responsible for it, they just forgot to turn when the other ships were coming in, and just pow, just like that. Scared the liver out of me.
Yeah, I read it put a pretty big hole in your hull. And how far was that from you, where the penetration happened?
I was below deck, and it came into our compartment.
So you're within feet of where bow of the other ship penetrated your hull.
It was about maybe from here out to the flowers out there.
So maybe 20, 30 feet, something like that?
Yeah, it wasn't too. It was big. There's a lot of metal showing it. I don't know why I thought it was that. I didn't concentrate on it that much. My mind was getting over this way and up on this to get my life jacket. That's number one. Yeah. Number two is what happened. And I thought it was torpedo, you know, to come in like that, come through the side of the ship. But I didn't realize it was a bow of another ship until I got up on top, up on the main deck, and I could see it. So then I had to say, well, it wasn't a torpedo. Whew, thank heavens. But then we might sink them, except that that other ship came alongside us. David's very smart of them to do that.
It's still a pretty close call, and there's another story here. You know, there's an expression, burying the lead, which means, you know, you didn't tell someone a very important detail. So we haven't shared with the listeners a very important detail here. Here you've been out to sea all this time, all those battles with the San Diego. Now you're on the Napa, and you didn't know how to swim?
Yeah, possibly. The San Diego went through the war without a scratch, and they had, after the war, you know, they put stringers up on the ship for the number of years or so that's in the battle. San Diego had the longest one. They went through the whole war, through all the fighting, not a scratch. It's just miraculous, it seems. There is a memorial in San Diego, next to the aircraft carrier, Midway, I guess, off the stern of it over here on the shore, there is a memorial to the San Diego. My name on it, just picture the ships on it. And down below, it's drawn the route of the San Diego that went through the whole war. And boy, I don't know how many miles it was on the thing, but that thing goes like all over. You look at it, wow, a lot of miles on that thing.
Well, and I'm wondering if there's more of a story here about you not being able to swim, because I've talked to guys who they had to have other people take their swim test for them to get through training. So because they abbreviated your training, they never made you prove that you could swim?
The immediate need was for men get out on the ships. I was only 2 weeks learning how to march. That's the only thing they tried us. And how to keep our gear clean and packed. In fact, there's a story there I missed. The gear. December, this is the old Navy, before the new and the war. New one was created by the war. So the old training camps, they had hammocks and a mattress, I think. And your gear is in a bag, and the mattress and the gear on springs. When you leave this thing, you take it up like this, and in between your gear for your all your clothing and stuff is in a sea bag, and then that sea bag gets put down, and the mattress goes up around it like that, and it's tied to it with the sea bag in the center of it. And I don't know the weight of that, but here's me, 150 pounds, probably maybe not that much. When you get out of the 2 weeks at the training camp, you got to put this thing on you and march out to wherever we're going, taking us into South Boston. It took me all I could do to just put it on my shoulder. And then I had to navigate, and we had to march down, get in a truck, I guess. How did we come down there? I guess on the train. I can't remember. it was so fast. But anyway, we get down to South Boston, and the Navy Yard there to go aboard the ship. The ship's sitting there, tied up to the dock in the water. And while I'm at it, the Queen Mary is in dry dock, just right here, getting redone to be a troop carrier. And there are guys go over the side scraping the ship. It's in a dry dock. And one of the guys falls off the thing they were scraping and fell to his death in that dry dock. And, oh, God, that was terrible. Anyway, here I come down to get aboard ship first time. It's just right tied up to dry dock. But there's a plank going down there. You got to walk from the deck down onto the ship. And so in my vision, the plank's about like this. And I got this thing all there. And I got water and got to walk over. When you get aboard ship, you know, you're supposed to salute, you know, the flag. I thought I was going to die. How am I going to navigate on that thin, that small piece of wood? But anyway, thank God I got there okay. Maybe they have to hand salute. Of course, the thing's on your left shoulder so you can salute. Yeah. And I get aboard and I just, boom. I hop on the deck.
I'm not trying to make too much of it, but I'm just wondering if not knowing how to swim ever caused you anxiety when you're out there in all these battles. Even, I mean, you mentioned seeing the guys jump off the Hornet. They have to survive in the water for who knows how long. Was that ever something that weighed on you or concerned you, the fact that you couldn't swim?
Yes, but I didn't worry about it. I mean, what is, what is. And there's too much stuff to do. That's I'm trying to get in my memory, you know, don't be a screwball and do something anyway. I was that kind of person. I was drawn back because I don't want to screw up on anything. But no, it didn't bother me. I tried one time, maybe it was in San Diego when I was going through that hydraulic school, that I tried to swim. I did a little dog paddle, I think, on the side, but I was quite close to them. I could grab something to hold on to. But no, it never did bother me aboard ship. Not at all. Because I knew that's why the life jacket is so important to me. That's why I always offset that fear, you know.
Well, and you were telling us about that incident off at Iwo Jima when the Napa was hit by an American ship and the hull was penetrated and all that. So what did that mean for you and the rest of the crew of the ship? What happened from there?
Well, when we got watertight compartments down below, which incidentally was one part was oil and the other part was food lock, refrigerated stuff. Both compartments mixed together and became garbage. And we actually, that's what you were. We smelled garbage when those things just coordinated and rotted together. And we went from there up to Midway after it was over and got a temporary patch on the side of it. And from there then we came back to the United States. So after we got through the war, oh, I forgot to tell you, my third ship was USS Oberon, and it's a supply ship. What happened was the woman I married, I told you about, North Hollywood, she came up to visit and stayed a week or two. They'd sent us down to somewhere on the lower coast to do some gunnery shooting. But anyway, she came up and spent some time while she became pregnant during that week or two that she was up there. And everything goes back. She goes back home and I get out on the... When she let me know about it, of course, it was in a letter. I was at sea, and we had that thing at Iwo Jima, and it had to come back. We came back into Tacoma. All the leave we could get was a weekend, and so that was only for guys that lived in the area. And so we might, the others were just a weekend thing. Well, that time I knew about my daughter, I haven't seen her yet, and she's down around Sacramento area. I couldn't get leave. I mean, a weekend, I could get a weekend. So I came down, and at that time, all the military used to hitchhike during the war because everybody would take a man in uniform and pick him. So that's what they did. They got on the road and hitchhiked down. Everything was okay, and it stayed there. So there for more than a weekend, and one of the guys calls me from the ship and says, "You better get back here." And I said, "Okay." So I leave, and I get up as far as north of Sacramento, and it was at nighttime, and a guy had left me off in the railroad town up there. But anyway, it's late, it's dark, and I get dumped off here, nothing going. And I'm colder, and I just had my pea coat on. I said, "Oh, this is it, I can't do this." So I turned around and I caught a ride back down. We're back down to Sacramento. Yeah, I stayed there too late and I missed the ship. So there I am, and I said, "Oh man, I better get the heck out of here and get back and do something, turn myself in." So I got up as far as Sacramento hitchhiking, and I turned myself into shore patrol. So they put me in the brig there on Treasure Island, I think, in the San Francisco Harbor. I went to the captain's mast and got sent to the brig. I forgot what my sentence was. But anyway, they sent me down to the brig where they make wooden pallets. And that's what I was doing, making wooden pallets in there. I'm maybe there a month, and suddenly they come to me and say, "Bob, if you want to get a dishonorable discharge, you can get it now. Or if you want to get a discharge under honorable conditions, you put a year in more." I said, "I'll take it." So that's what happens to me. I get sent out to another ship, and this is the Oberon, and it's a supply ship. And this is right towards the end of the war. I think the war had ended in Europe by then. So I signed up for another year in the Navy. They put me on the Oberon. It's a supply ship. And here I am. We're going to have to go to China. I'm not a gunner's mate anymore. I'm a seaman, second class, when I get out of the brig. What happens is, but I'm there, I got a year in the service, and so I got a stripe on my arm showing that I've 4 years in. So captain of the ship gave me the job of running the captain's boat. I'm a gunner's mate. They chased me. But I have 4 years, so they say I must know something about it. And this is a supply ship, so it's not anything like the carrier or some large big ship. It's not fancy with all the doodads on it. Just run the damn thing. So I said, "Okay, I'll do it." And then I did, and it scared the life out of me because I'd never done one. I never even looked at one. Oh, I've looked at them. But to run one and control the speed and to stop and run it in reverse and slow down and get to the dock and not crash into the side of the ship. I don't know where I got the nerve to do that, honest to Pete. But yeah, we got assigned to it, man. So you got to do it. So I did it, and I surprised myself.
I want to ask you about, you know, you told us that story about getting a weekend pass and going down to meet your daughter for the first time because you found out in a letter that she had been born, but you've never met her. And this is what leads to you getting in trouble and losing your rank and all of that. Was it worth it to go meet your daughter for the first time?
Of course. I wouldn't have gone.
And I wouldn't have gone back either.
I'm her father, and she's a great girl.
And it's a special Father's Day weekend for Bob McAvoy, who would end up meeting his second wife after the war in a chance encounter at Los Angeles's Griffith Park Observatory. The youngest of his children got to visit Washington, D.C. with Bob this year, thanks to Central Valley Honor Flight. And we'll hear from father and son about that experience when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is. Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit this Father's Day weekend with a proud father named Bob McAvoy. During World War II, he served aboard three different ships, and nothing over all the years since has stirred up those Navy memories like the journey he got to take this spring with his youngest son, Greg. They traveled to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight.
This guy came up with the idea. Somebody talked to him about it, and he didn't even know about it. So he goes ahead and thinks the thing out. First thing I know, Dad, what about doing this? Huh? He wanted to go to Washington, D.C. And he heard about it was free for me. And I thought it was a fantastic idea, too. But first thing off, I had been there before with my second wife. We went across country and stopped in D.C. Trouble is, the parking there, we hit it on the middle of a day. To be able to put the car somewhere in, you have to do a lot of walking. She wasn't too impressed about the walking idea. And so we didn't get to see too much. The only thing we got up close to was the Jefferson Memorial. But it was an honor, honestly. There was a 70 group and two World War II veterans out of 70. I thought, wow. And the other guy is like me. We became buddies, the two of us, and still are. His guardian, I suppose you know what a guardian is, Greg is mine, and his other name is George, and he's 98. And in the service, I'm 98, because I had to say I was 17 when I went in as when I was really 16. So in the Navy, I'm 98 years old, and he's 98 too. So the both of us, and there's only two of us anyway, left in this 70 group. Whenever we go anywhere, we were both in pushers. Everywhere we go, we have our pictures taped in a group. The two of us, George and I, are up front sitting in the thing, and he's standing behind us. And the guy he's standing behind you with us was George. Robbie, they call him. They became buddies. The four of us, we came like this. We were always in the front for the pictures. And we'd go over in somewhere else, a parade or something. We'd be putting out there in front of the buses. We'd be in them first off, get in them and get out. It was a fantastic thing, I'm telling you. It really was.
So there's very few people who ever have the opportunity to lay a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier. What was that like for you to do that?
I was nervous as could be. Oh, Lord have mercy. He didn't get to push me out there. They had somebody else. But anyway, the two of us go up there, and then he pushed us forward, and there's this big wreath and a Marine behind it with a good grip on it. And we go to make the presentation. We're wheeled out there, and then we go like this, and we're right at it, and it's right square in front of us. And I reach over to pretend like I'm helping him with it. And he's backing. And I get up like this, and with my right hand, I hold on to it. And this Marine behind has got a lock on it from behind, facing us. And I grabbed some of the flowers, and then I came back from it, and the flowers were still in my hand. They fell down on the ground. And, oh, Lord, I was so embarrassed. I couldn't even look up when they wheeled me back to the end of the crowd. It was so embarrassing. And I don't know how many seconds later, I go over and look to see if I could see it. It was gone. I don't know how in the heck they got that off the deck. And it's such a quick thing. I'll never forget that. That was embedded in my mind as the embarrassment of my life.
In general, that whole, your whole experience on the honor flight from takeoff to landing, how did it make you feel? Did it make you feel like maybe some people value what you did for our country?
Absolutely. Merry Christmas. You don't have to pay a penny on anything. I didn't spend a penny anywhere on that flight. And to be honored by that, especially when with our age, we were 98 years old and not in front on anything. It was wonderful. And it's the only time I have ever had anybody attention because of my age and what we went through during the war. It was so fantastic that it makes me real good. I put some juice into me, I think, because being 97, my health is pretty doggone good, if you ask my doctor. I don't have much things. I take medications, but that's to keep my body under control. My doctor's got me on prescriptions to keep me healthy. The only problem is my equilibrium. That's my deadly part, because I fell once, and once was enough for me. No, but I fell a second time at home, but that wasn't too bad. But other than that, I'm good. So I'm going to shoot for 200, I guess. I mean, oh, God.
Let's get to 100 first. How about when you got back to Fresno and the bagpipers led you through that procession and you got some sailors standing there at attention for an old sailor? What was that like?
Fantastic. But it's problematic. Most of the guys were returning the salute. But I'm a civilian. I'm not a naval man anymore. So I'm a civilian. So I think that the proper salute for me is to put my hand over my heart, especially when I hear the Pledge of Allegiance or things of that nature.
And since this is a radio program and some of the people listening weren't there, didn't see it, can you describe for us what you saw as you came out into that airport terminal?
Oh, it was beautiful. I was in awe, honest to Pete. And those guys in uniform, hot diggity damn, they sure looked good. And they carried it off the way they did. And I never thought that Fresno, we're putting this out like such a terrific greeting, honestly. With George and I up front, come out there.
If there's anything else that's, you know, important to you, I don't want to leave it out, but I also don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a little bit about it. I do have another question. Maybe it's not easy, but at 97 or 98 years old, depending on who we ask, is there something that you look back on and you say, you know, that's what I'm most proud of, or that's what I'm most thankful for?
At times, I think that I should have been better at it, but mainly my family, without a doubt. Lord have mercy. I'm so lucky to have such a children that I do have. The only problem is being Catholic. I have to keep after them. I've written them things of our religion over the years, hoping that they might realize the importance of religion in a person's life, because I hope that they'll be in heaven one day.
Since you brought that up, I guess I should ask you too, because you told us, you know, quite a few stories from your time in the Navy. Are there moments throughout that, especially as we think about, you just said, you know, your family is what you're most thankful for, and a lot of them would have never been born if you didn't make it home from the war. Were there times that you look back on and you feel that God protected you, or there was some kind of divine intervention in your survival?
When I saw that torpedo go past our stern, you're doggone right I do. If you were in my shoes and you saw that, you would wonder, stay away from me. That was the biggest thing. But no, being a father is the best thing in my life, I think. the way my family live, and I just love them so much. Oh, yeah, well, one thing we were talking about like this, I wonder sometimes if I did not go to San Diego for that hydraulic thing and stayed on the San Diego and gone through the whole war on the San Diego. My life, I don't know. God does what controls the rest of it, but I think my life might have been, it may be the same. It may ever come out the same, but the whole thingamajig of it would change completely different. That's the only thing I wonder about. You know, I'm just skylining in my mind. Yeah. What if, when that ship got back to the States, they were out of the Navy right now. That's why that extra year I put in, that Navy wanted me one more year, because they lost so many on all this. Everybody got out of the service after the war.
You kind of slipped it in there that, like a lot of guys in this time period, you lied about your age to get in the service. So that means your grandparents had to play along and sign that you could go in and that you were older than you said you were?
What happened was that he went to my dad. I don't know how all this happened, because we were living with my grandparents.
Right.
But he contacted my dad and thought about, would you want your son to join the Navy? Or he wanted to go in the Navy. That's what I guess. It must have worked, because my dad wasn't there, but he was somewhere where my grandfather reached him and told him what the situation was. And so I guess my dad asked my granddad what he thought about it, because my granddad knew that I was a rapscallion. I'm full of juice and not too compliant with doing what I was supposed to be doing. But anyway, however the situation came out, the fact was that my dad had to write a letter and say that I was 17 years old. And that's what I used when I went back and enlisted. December 18th, 1941, I enlisted. Because my grandfather said it could be a job for him. They'd train him. That's what they did.
And the rest is history. He lied about his age to get into the Navy, even though he couldn't swim, survived service on 3 different ships, and put in an extra year after a trip to meet his newborn daughter for the first time could have ended up with a dishonorable discharge. Bob McAvoy has taken us on quite a journey this Father's Day weekend, but before we sign off, how about a quick word from his son, Greg, who accompanied Bob on that Central Valley Honor flight to Washington, D.C. Did you learn anything about your dad on this 3-day honor flight that maybe you didn't know or realize before?
I learned the strength he had going through the war and the experiences he's had, and just the trauma that you don't realize what these young guys go through and experience. It's just amazing what the stories you can tell and how he can vividly recollect what happened at the time. It's amazing.
Is there a part of his story, maybe a memory he shared, maybe just lying about his age and getting in at 16? I mean, is there a part of his story that you look at and you say, boy, I don't know if I could do that, or I don't know how he did that?
The part where the torpedo goes over the bow of the ship was interesting, how he reacted to it and can still see it in his mind is what's really amazing.
Sharing that honor flight experience with him, what was the highlight of all that for you?
To me, it was the Arlington Cemetery and the changing of the guard, watching that and having him lay the wreath on the unknown soldier. That's probably the best part of the trip. And the camaraderie of the group of 150 people together, the volunteers, the guardians, all the vets, it just seemed like everybody had the country in their mind and the honor that we show these vets. I'll take that with me the rest of my life.
And is there something about your dad that you really appreciate or respect? Why does he mean so much to you?
I respect his determination and his faith. He preaches as a Catholic 24/7. I'm still learning as I go along, but I respect his beliefs, how he raised in a family at that time. I've raised my family the best I can, and probably the common denominator is we're both so proud of our family. It's a good role model. Hopefully I'll make it to 100 also, or 200 as he says.
Don't put it past him. If you're blessed to still have your dad in your life like Greg McAvoy and his siblings are, you know what to do this weekend. I'm glad you spent this hour with us on Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you can join us again next time when we'll be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.